Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Nick Britton. Nick Britton is a former guest on the Bob Inyart Live TV program from 13 years ago. Nick appeared on the show as a young man, two episodes in some wild makeup and one in a suit. And in the past month, we've aired those TV shows in Denver, the two with Nick in the makeup. And if you get the Bob Inyart Live televised classics in the mail on DVD monthly, then you will also see the fun programs that I had with Nick. Now, Doug McBurney is not in studio today, but he tracked down Nick and found him living in the Midwest. And so I'm happy to announce that we have him on the line. Nick Britton, welcome back to Bob Inyart Live.
Hi, Bob. How you doing?
It's great to hear your voice, Nick. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Thanks.
Well, before we talk shop, how in the world are you? What's going on in your life?
I'm feeling pretty old now. I can't believe it was 13 years ago. That's a while.
Yeah, so how old are you now?
I'm 31.
31. All right. I think we met, Nick, at an event where you and a couple guys came to protest one of my events.
Right.
And that was a cordial meeting, right? We had a good time.
I remember our first meeting was you were offering us milk and cookies, actually.
Oh, yeah. That's right. You guys were protesting, I think it was a seminar or something, in South Bend, Indiana. And so I came out and welcomed you guys, and we had homemade chocolate chip cookies. And I asked, well, since you guys are here, would you like some cookies and milk? And I think one of the other guys was starting to say yes, and you gave him a look, and he said, no, thanks.
I don't remember, but yeah, I can picture those. Those guys don't usually turn away cookies too much.
So. Yeah. Do you still know those guys? Because they came to the studio also.
Yeah, we're all still friends.
Oh, that's great. Well, how about education, jobs, marriage? What are you up to?
I'm married now.
Congratulations.
Thanks. I have a couple kids, actually.
Wow.
As far as education, I'm kind of an oddball in my group. Maybe we'll get to this a little bit, but I got my master's in English. And now I work for a local college around here. Yeah, I know the master's in English. Don't worry, I'm not. I have some disagreements with my demographic, I guess. And I teach here at a college here in the Midwest area. So.
All right, super. And so, couple kids, what age?
They're pretty young. I have an 8-year-old and a 3-year-old.
All right. Cheryl and I, between us, we have 7 boys, and they go from 8 years old up to 28.
Oh, wow.
So your 8-year-old is your oldest, and that's our youngest.
I'm hoping it gets a little easier. My daughter's pretty easy to deal with, but my son's got, he's all boy. So
he's all boy.
Yeah, that's...
We have a few of those all boy kids.
Yeah, right.
And there's a book that we have distributed through the show for many years called Train Up a Child. Nick, this book is, I don't know, it's a small paperback. It's maybe 80 pages. And we have used it, and hundreds of families we know now through the show have used this book. And our time with our kids is so enjoyable. The kids are so respectful, polite. They get along with one another better. And it's just a blessing. It's the opposite of what our culture says. This has to do with discipline, and there's some spanking involved. But I can't remember the last time I spanked any of our kids. Maybe 6 months ago I spanked our 26-year-old.
No, right.
I'm only kidding. Boy, what a joy. And it's the old school, the old style way of raising kids.
Yeah, I sometimes joke with my family that we only have one rule in the house. And that's don't disturb dad. So if you're doing something and you just ask yourself, is this going to disturb dad?
Yeah.
And if it is, then stop.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Now, if our kids, you know, kids are kids and they get rambunctious and sometimes they get a little bit loud and some of their noises can be annoying. And we tell them, if you guys want to be annoying, go in your room and close the door, go in the basement, but don't be annoying around adults. And they could learn that. They figure that out.
Oh, yeah. I know that's, I guess, an issue you and your listeners are involved with, and, is how to discipline children.
Right.
And, in our house, we use some spanking once in a while. With my daughter, it never comes up. I mean, she's very studious and quiet. And once in a while, my son, it's more the threat of it than the actual doing it.
Yeah.
You know, this is an option. And so usually once we say, hey, look, I'm going to count to three, and then if you haven't stopped by then, you know, what's happening, I never get to two.
Well, that is good. That's good that you don't get to two, and he's respectful. And there are all different ways of raising kids. But this book, when we're done, if you'd like it, I'll be happy to send you a copy. I've never in my life said, I'm going to count to 10 or I'm going to count to 3. I've literally never said that.
Yeah.
And when it comes time for the kids to go to bed, and we're talking about all age kids, time to go to bed, and they run up to us, they give us hugs, kisses, and they go and they do their whole bed routine. It's really a joy. And this is the old-fashioned way. I know the newfangled way is different, but I like the old-fashioned way, Nick.
I always give my daughter, we usually read for about 20 to 30 minutes right before bed. And sometimes I'll say, okay, well, we're done. And she'll say, oh, I want one more chapter. And I'll say, no, it's time for bed. And then she's usually pretty agreeable about it. She doesn't.
Yeah. Well, that's it. What a blessing. What a blessing to do that.
Oh, yeah, I'm very
all right.
Very fortunate.
You can't really get to more substantive issues than things like marriage and children.
Right.
That's about as substantive as you can get. Relationships are the most important things in all of existence. But before we get to more worldview aspects of all that, how about adventures? Have you had anything? Have you taken any trips that you've enjoyed? Or?
Oh, wow. Boy, it seems like I'm constantly on some sort of whirlwind trip. It's, adulthood is weird. I joke with my wife sometimes that, you know, and this isn't exactly true. It's, you know, it'd be nice if it was, but men don't really grow up. You know, we're just still,
right.
She'll sometimes be jealous. How come you get to be goofy all the time? And
right.
I've got to be the mature one. And,
right.
And that's something I try to encourage. I let her think that, you know, because it's fun. You know, it's fun being the oldest kid in the house. And I do try to take, life with, I guess, a little bit of, you've got video of the adventure I try to take life with.
And yeah. Now, does your wife let you dress up in that makeup, or is that?
My most famous night, I guess, or one of my most famous nights, and it had to be like that. I probably did that a handful of times.
In your whole life, right?
Yeah, that was on two episodes, of course. That was a lot of people may not realize that was one night.
One night.
We filmed those back to back.
It's not like you came back 3 weeks later and you're still
right.
Dressed up in makeup.
Right. I mean, I had done it. I once at a summer institute I went to as a high school student. I did it that night, and I'm pretty sure that was about it. I've kind of my wife's understanding about it. She went through a similar phase.
All right.
You know, it maybe kind of trivializes teenagehood.
Hey, Nick, there are photos out there of me from when I was a teenager, and I was in a rock band in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even want to describe what it was
right.
like, but it's not all that different from what you looked like.
I think maybe, I'm hoping at least, that being embarrassed of your teen years is part of growing up.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah. Hopefully.
Okay, so could we get now into your view of the world, your view
sure.
of religion? Who is Nick Britton? Who do you think you are? Where did you come from?
Well, I've remained politically active. I've kind of, I was looking for a lot of answers back then, and I still am. I it sounds cliche to say, you know, that the more I learn, I realize the less I know. But,
right.
It actually seems kind of accurate that back then it was kind of to plagiarize Mark Twain, you know, he made that comment that when he was 20 years old, his dad was the stupidest man he'd ever met. And 10 years later, he was amazed how much the man had learned.
Right.
It does seem similar to that the more the older I get, it seems like, wow, I don't know anything. You know, I'm still a tiny speck. And my view on religion, I consider myself agnostic, and I'm not one of those agnostics that actually means atheist. Because I run into those, you know, in my circles, I travel these, you know, intellectual, very smart, high degree kinds of crowds, and they know it. They're very, very aware of how intelligent they are.
Mm.
And they have all the answers, of course. And they say, well, there's no God. And they point to some sort of fact or whatever that proves that there's no God.
Mm.
I would be very reluctant to make such a bold claim. In my view, it's much easier to prove that there is a God than that there's not one.
Mm.
And of course, you agree with that, but I think that even from this more agnostic, you know, not coming from a a Christian faith background, God can always be hiding around the next corner. You know, that maybe it's, you know, he hasn't chosen to reveal himself to you, or maybe you are denying him or whatever reason, but it seems like it's much easier to say that he is there than that he's not. And so when somebody says, oh, I'm confident there is no God, it's, well, you're a brave person. You know, that's, you've been given something that I don't have, because I'm always open to it. I have for a lot of very faithful friends, you know, very devoted friends with their respective religions, and I take every opportunity to talk to them because about that, because they have totally different views.
Yeah.
And, well, some of them are very similar. Yeah, that's what's interesting about it. Sometimes this is an issue I'd like to get to. I watch Christians fight sometimes about, well, you believe this and that's wrong, and it seems like so much of the Christian faith is so similar. You know, that once you've got the concept of an all-powerful being that's all-encompassing, and that you then have this tangible human version, you know, either of him or of his son, or, you know, something beyond human, and then that person was able to transcend life and death, it seems like, if, you know, you've got that down, that's pretty big. You know, there shouldn't be the infighting that I see sometimes that kind of bothers me. I have a Mormon friend, and then I have a couple of friends that are more evangelical.
Well, Jesus, if you recall, Nick, Jesus warned the world about his own followers. And he said, many will come in my name, and they will deceive many.
And, right.
And to me, that's one of the examples of the flavor of realism in the Bible. Like, there are many people who say, well, the Bible's just the book of myths that happened to be written and collected by a certain tribe of people a long time ago, and they're really no different than any other tribe of people. We just happen to have their myths still hanging around.
Right.
Well, the Bible has this flavor of realism where it's written by the Jews, but on virtually every page, it shows how wicked the Jews are, even their greatest leaders. Their priests, their prophets are evil. Their kings are evil. Even their greatest kings are evil. And their greatest patriarchs of the faith are evil. And so that has a strong sense of realism to me, because when you read the writings of the other ancient cultures, like the king of Sumeria or wherever, of Persia, Media Persia, they're
really godlike.
Yeah, they present themselves as though they're God. They are the king of kings, the lord of lords, the god of the whole earth. They do nothing but heap praise upon themselves and only condemn their enemies. You read the Bible, and you find out that the apostles who wrote the New Testament show all their wickedness and selfishness and lack of faith, and the prophets and the kings of the Old Testament, I mean, they're all basket cases. They're horrendous, and yet this became the book of the Jews and then the book of the Christians. So to me, that's a flavor of realism.
Yeah, it takes a certain amount of courage and honesty to take David, for example, you know, who's so important. He's cited by Jesus himself, you know, with,
right,
this is why I'm, you know, who I am. This is, you know, I trace my lineage to him, and he commits a double sin. You know, he's an adulterous murderer. And,
yeah, about as bad as you can get. You can get pretty bad, but that's way up there on the wicked scale. And that's King David.
Yeah, that's he's one of the, you know, fathers of religion. So and that's why I look at things like that. And being a, you know, I put a tremendous amount of in my own life on emphasis on literature and the stories. I think we can learn a lot about people by the symbols that they choose to express. You know, the stories that they pass down. What's meaningful to them. And when I look at that, that's
Nick,
important.
Could we take that for a moment, the stories, but one final point to close that last point.
Sure.
You said that Christians will dispute amongst themselves, and oh boy, are you right. You know, all human beings do that, but Christians do it about Christian things. And Jesus said that many will come in my name, and they will deceive many. So to set our eyes on him and beware of his followers. Now, when you go to Allah or Muhammad, you don't find Muhammad warning the world about his own followers. If anything, you know, my followers are going to be the key to everything on earth. But Jesus warned the world about his followers, and that's an example, I think, of that flavor of realism that, wow, Jesus knew something that the founders of the other religions didn't quite know.
A friend of mine, he was talking about how simple Jesus puts it, that love God, love your neighbor. And it's basically, it's just nice and concise and to the point. And, you know, of course, you have the other history and the other things beyond that, but he was challenging somebody once. Another Christian, he got into an argument with this person, and he said, we both know that the Bible says this. Will you, in front of these people, admit that you love me? And the guy wouldn't do it.
Well, now that I got to hand it to your friend. That's impressive. And your friend might not be a Christian. He might have an anti-Christian worldview. I don't know. But that's impressive.
Well, he's Mormon, so.
All right, but that is absolutely impressive. Nick, over the years, occasionally I've been on the air for 20 years, 5 days a week, and so critics who don't like me, they'll say, well, he's a racist.
Mm-hmm.
For example,
oh, yeah.
My response has always been from the first week I'm on the air, if somebody says that, because if you're a conservative, you're called a racist in America.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And so I said, well, is it because I love blacks and respect them? Because I enjoy Jewish people, that I love them, I value them as much as anyone from my own family? Is that what makes me a racist? That I really love blacks and I love to be with them? Is that what makes me a racist? And then that accusation seems to fall flat.
You know, I consider myself a libertarian. And again, I think it's so difficult when you start throwing terms out there, because I know that people like Bill Maher and I'm sure Michael Moore, people like that, consider themselves libertarians too. But I look at myself as the actual, and of course we all do, right? I'm sure they look at themselves as the actual libertarians. But
yeah.
But I look at it, I believe in humans. I believe in the individual. And so people say, oh, well, you're libertarian, isn't that, that's some sort of conservative, right? And it's, well, not really. I mean, we're not liberals, but we're not exactly, you know, you're kind of in the right direction. Sometimes we might, you know, shop at the same stores or something, you know, I mean, a conservative, but not exactly the same worldview, but
yeah, a libertarian, when I view the political spectrum, you know, some people think it's based on the size of government. And if you believe in small government, you're right wing, and big government, you're left wing, things like that. I view the political spectrum, and I think that's false. The size of government just happens to be a coincidence of your worldview. It's not as though small government is what defines you. And so that eventually you have no government at all. That'd be anarchy. That's really
right.
Small. Well, that's not especially right wing. I believe government, the political spectrum, is defined on absolutes, absolute truth, absolute right and wrong. And so the right wing, as I define it, and as I think it would be defined scripturally, the right believes in absolutes and the left believes in relativism. And
right.
So there's moral relativism, there is no truth, there are no absolutes, and so on. And so you could be a socialist because God saying thou shalt not steal is not relevant to you. So you can take as much money as you can get away with from your neighbors and use it to modify society however you please. It's up to you. There are no absolutes.
Right.
And so I think that absolutes are probably the best spectrum to use to evaluate political positions.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. And I can, see, because people, you speak about absolutes, and I read a lot with theory. You know, I've been reading recently about the existentialists, and they sometimes I'll be at the university or something like that, and I'll say, well, what about Sartre? He makes this point that, you know, we can't trust our own senses, you know, that we can't prove that we're not insane, we can't prove that our senses are accurate, and I suppose in a certain way I could, maybe I'm not actually having this conversation, I guess I can't prove that this isn't really going on.
Well, you could be dreaming, right? You could be dreaming,
right.
You could be hallucinating. People do dream, and we wake up and we think that
seems
was
real,
so real. I actually thought I was falling out of an airplane.
Right, and I suppose, potentially, I'll give a point to Sartre for that one. However, we really can't function in a world like that, where we just walk around saying, I don't know, you know, that none of this is real, and I can't prove any of this is real, so none of it matters. I'll just take whatever I want and live for the moment. We have to assume that And it is an assumption that we can trust our senses. We have to assume that we can trust our own sanity. So
well,
that is, we have to basically essentially create, I guess.
A presuppositional view, for example, that the universe is rational versus that the universe is not rational.
Right.
You're introducing some of my favorite topics. And so there are three right here that you've introduced, and I've jotted them down. I'd like to go through them. You mentioned stories a few minutes ago.
Sure.
And then can we trust our senses and our suppositions? So to get back to stories for a moment, some books, like in Eastern mysticism, you have a lot of holy books that are teachings about ideas. And they tend to be different than the Bible in that the Bible is primarily a history book. The Bible is this huge storybook of purported history, and it does take time out to have poetry and meditation and all, but overwhelmingly, the Old and New Testament, it's history. It's telling us claimed historical events, and there's something fabulous about that, I believe, Nick, because stories, you could watch a movie that is a foreign language movie, and maybe you don't have subtitles on. And if it's a good movie, you can understand the movie.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
You know who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, what's at stake, what the sacrifice is, who won. You get the story. Mm-hmm. And stories could be translated into other languages as the Bible's being translated into over 1,000 languages. It's already translated into hundreds of languages. And even if the translators are not the best translators in the world, they're translating it into Fugian or something,
right. You
still get the message of the story, and that is so powerful. And so when we look at the world, that the world keeps a 7-day week for the most part,
mm-hmm.
and the world knows so much of the story of the Bible. And the Bible's been translated into so many languages. And so if God were to reveal himself, this is the brilliant way to do it. In a book that's a lengthy enough story so that even if some of the copiers left out some pages, even if some of the translators did a lousy job, anyone in the world, for the most part, can find out what the story is and learn the moral of the story.
Sure. Yeah, And I don't want to exclude necessarily, you know, there's value in other texts too. You know, I don't think that necessarily that, read about Taoism or something like that. You know, there's some nice stories and those some concepts that are valuable.
If you have something that's primarily didactic, it's just teaching you apart from, you know, you have the moral of the story, you
mm-hmm.
have the story and the moral of the story. That's really powerful. If you just have the morals, then that's strong, but it's not as powerful as the story and the moral.
It's nice to have that tangibility, you know, and I think that as Americans, we're a tangible people. You know, we like to be, and by that I mean that
right.
we want to see it, we and we believe that it's real.
When we can see it. Well, for example, like if God says in his holy book that people are sinful, okay, that's a statement. And it's posited, and we could try to comprehend it. But then if he says people are sinful, and to try to address this and forgive them, I am sending my son to pay for that sin, and he is scourged, he suffers, he's innocent, but he dies a terrible death, crucified on the cross, and that's what it required to pay for the depth of your sin, then all of a sudden, saying sin is bad has way more meaning. Because here we see it's quantified through the story, the suffering Jesus Christ went through. That's what it means when I sin against my wife or my children or my friend. I hurt other people, and that's not a minor issue. That's a major issue, my sin.
And this is one thing that kind of bothers me politically is that, you know, those on, you know, the left, you know, the people who I think, and I don't want to say even necessarily the left, I mean, because like you say, there are, doesn't necessarily have to do with the size of government, but all of these, I don't even know what to call them, but, you know, I have a friend, you know, actually one of the guys who was there at the, that night. Deeply, deeply socialist, admittedly socialist. You know, he has no problems with the term. And he, you know, he makes a good living. You know, he's well off. He's not married. Gets to spend it all on himself, and he does. Saves some of it, but he lives a nice lifestyle. And he'll tell me, you know, from this house that he owns, on his expensive cell phone, you know, with these nice tangible goods around him, about how bad the poor have it, about how wicked the man is, he calls him.
And, yeah, how wicked society is because the poor, they have color TV and $100 tennis shoes. And
I'll explain that to him, that, you know, the poor have it pretty good.
Pretty well in this country. Now, Nick, could you hold on a second? Because we'd like to take a break and then continue. When we come back after the break, you had mentioned, can we trust our own senses? And I'd like to suggest something. We'll deal with your friend and his thought of the poor. But, you know, I could be dreaming. That's true.
Right.
But I cannot be a figment of someone else's dream. That's not possible.
Right.
So I can be dreaming. But as Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. So we've reached a point today with relativism that I go on a college campus and I get people who don't know if they exist or not.
Right, yeah. Oh, I get it all the time.
Yeah, the curator of the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, Dr. Kirk Johnson, I call him Captain Kirk, he doesn't know if he exists.
Well, yeah, that's what's, and basically, okay, well, if you don't know that you're real, well, then I probably don't have much of value to say to me then.
Yeah, so I believe that's where leftism is taking us into extraordinary ignorance. But if you can't hold on, thank you, Nick.
Oh, yeah.
All right, and we'll be back. It'll air tomorrow, but Lord willing, we'll continue with Nick right now. Our website is kgov.com, Maranatha Christian Center. What a great school.